seemed to be possible. And he had a whole series of first-person accounts of that in the book. Well, I read the book nonstop, and as soon as I put the book down, I picked up the phone, and I called Kaplow Roshi in Rochester. And to my astonishment, he answered the phone, which he never did. I mean, they have secretaries and assistants and so forth, they answer phones. He picked up the phone, said, hello, I introduced myself. I said, Roshi, I've just finished Three Pillars of Zen. I want to come up to Rochester and do a sesshin. It's a very intensive 7-day retreat. He said, well, I don't think so, not a sesshin. You come up and you do an introductory weekend, see how you get on. I said, no, I really want to do a sesshin. So we went back and forth and we compromised and I did the introductory weekend. But that set me off on a path, even though it was not a Zen path. As powerful as that was, it was not a Zen path. That was not my path. And the third book was by Nyanaponika Thera. Right, some of you also will know that. He actually is German by birth, but spent most of his life as a monk in Sri Lanka, Theravada monk. And the book was about his study and practice under the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw in Rangoon. Well, no one just dropped this book into my hand. I was driving the car to school one day by a route that I had never taken before. All of a sudden, I jammed on the brakes and turned into this parking lot, screeching into this parking lot. And the car stopped. I stopped and said, why am I here? What just happened? I had no idea what happened. I didn't even know where I was. So I looked around, and across the street on the other side, there was this little shop that said Vivekananda Bookstore. I didn't know who Vivekananda was. I didn't know anything about anything in those days. But something compelled me to get out of the car, cross the street, go into the bookstore. It was very dark, all these Sanskrit titles that meant nothing to me. But way in the back corner, there was a light that was shining down on these 12 Buddhist books. I don't know why they were in there. And one of them was The Heart of Buddhist Meditation. I said, oh, that looks interesting. I'll take that. So I bought it, took it, read it that night. Again, it set me off on a path that eventually went to Burma to study with Mahasi Sayadaw, and then to India, and then to here. That one book had the power to do all of that. But again, apropos of the neckties, I gave it to my partner at the time. She said, well, if this was so, had such an impact on you, let me read it. Maybe I'll be interested in it. She gave it back to me later that night. She said, this is the most boring book I've ever read. So, one person's calling is not necessarily another's. So now this fourth book is threatening to do the same thing again, to be a calling, to set me out again on some kind of path that I don't understand. All I know from past experience is that you ignore those callings at your peril. And this is Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj's book, I Am That. It's a transcription of his satsangs with different students. Each chapter is like a Q&A, except it's not really a Q&A, it's more like a satsang in a traditional sense. A student will come and ask any question under the sun, and Nisargadatta will answer. I think a teacher gave this to me at a Yucca Valley retreat some years ago. I don't remember. All I know is I've kept it with me ever since. It's been on my night table for 35 years. It's one of the first things I pack when I go on the road. Even if I don't get to it, it's always there. So these students come to him as a teacher, a very well-known teacher. And what do you go to a teacher for? We don't have so many teachers here, so maybe not all of you have had an opportunity to do that. But what do you go to a teacher for? I think here in the West, we go for many, many reasons. Oh, you want to feel better? We want to reduce the stress of our day-to-day lives. We want to understand ourselves better. Maybe we're recovering from some illness or injury or accident. We go for a multitude of reasons. And mindfulness can help with all of those things. You found that, I'm sure, you wouldn't be here tonight. In fact, it sometimes seems when you look at the journals and the magazines and the news, sometimes seems that mindfulness is good for everything, right? It's kind of a universal solvent. But the one thing many of us don't go to a teacher for is for enlightenment, is to awaken. Especially awaken from this dream of me. Why is this? Well, probably a number of reasons. Traditionally, it was taboo to talk about enlightenment. Traditional Buddhist countries, they don't talk about it. In fact, there's a prohibition in the Vinaya, the monastic code of conduct, that prohibits students from talking about enlightenment experience or aspiration for enlightenment. You can talk about it with your teacher, but that's all. I ran into that problem when I was doing my research in Calcutta. That was the cover story. I was doing my doctoral research. That was the cover story for really being able to go and study this wonderful practice. But the way I had set up the research, I needed people who had experienced at least the first stage of enlightenment in this Theravada system. And when I proposed that to my teacher and asked him if he would help me find subjects, he was shocked. I think he hung in there because I lived with him for a year and he trusted me, so this was outrageous. But eventually, with a lot of discussion back and forth, he agreed to take me to Calcutta, introduce me to Deepa Ma, and between the two of them, they would help me find students who had reached one of these stages of enlightenment. But I suspect that even though we don't talk about it, and it's prohibited to talk about it in some quarters, it still remains a hidden aspiration, I think probably for most of us. We're just hesitant to own it. And there's a backstory to that. Even though this is a teacher's main function in the Dharma, it's not to help us feel better. I mean, that's a byproduct sometimes. It's wonderful when that happens, but that isn't the core aspiration. A little while later, the same student challenges Nisargadatta, and he quotes Krishnamurti. Everyone quotes Krishnamurti when they want to justify something outrageous. He quotes Krishnamurti as saying, "A guru is not needed." Typical Krishnamurti statement. A guru is not needed. And Nisargadatta's reply is simply, someone must tell you about the supreme reality and the way that leads to it. That's the teacher's function. Telling us about the supreme reality. There is a supreme reality and the way to it. My teacher loved to talk about it. He was one of those few Buddhist teachers who really, he talked day, hours, hours, from morning, noon, and night. He's still talking, hours at a time. But for him, it wasn't a hidden thing or a secret thing. It was very natural. You do the practice, and this is what happens. It cannot not happen. That was his attitude. It cannot not happen. It must happen. It's as natural as falling off a log. And Adyashanti, the former Zen student, now teaching on his own, one of Adyashanti's lines that's dearest to me, my heart, had that same power when I first read it. He said, it's in our nature to awaken. And that's a wonderful thought to hold. It's in our nature to awaken. It's not some peripheral thing. All parts of us yearn to awaken, to be free. And when you think about it, how can we realize anything that we don't aspire to? It's crazy. Or something that we don't want, or something that we don't desire. Part of the problem maybe is that we're often looking for something we think we don't have. It lies somewhere else. Or it's something that we're striving to be on the way toward, but it's not there yet. If it's not here, not now, then it's never going to be here. It's who we are. It's funny, you know, we do the same thing in relationships that we often do in Dharma. How do we choose our partners? Not to open up a can of worms. We often choose a partner based on they bring to us something that we don't feel we are. They complement us in some way. This is why the relationship always runs into trouble. Until we realize that what we're looking to them to bring to us, we have to find in ourselves. And lo and behold, it's already there once we really look. But we make that same mistake. So the student comes to Sri Nisargadatta. I wish I had a picture of him. Although you can pull him up on YouTube. There's quite a number of videos of him on YouTube. He's not a Buddhist, as I said. He's a Vedanta yogi in the Hindu tradition. So his language is a bit different from ours. I mean, I suppose some Buddhists talk about the supreme reality, but more likely to talk about Buddha nature. And he's not at all the classic image of a teacher, of a yogi. You'll see this if you pull him up on YouTube. He's shouting sometimes. He's gesticulating wildly. He's bouncing up and down in his chair. I mean, he does not look like your image of a famous spiritual teacher. In fact, he was also what he was by profession was a bidi wala. You know what bidis are? Those little cigarettes, they wrap tobacco in a grape leaf and put some red twine around it, and that's your cigarette. That's what his family did for livelihood. They sold cigarettes. It's like Michael and Narayan selling cigarettes down in the front here on the way in the, you know. That's the Nisargadatta. And in the middle of some of his talks, you can hear him. He'll lean over and he's yelling downstairs because his meditation room was on top of the cigarette shop. And he's yelling downstairs telling his wife and his son to come up and listen to the talk. They never come up. ran into a very similar thing with my teacher in Bodh Gaya. A lot of Westerners would come by him, or they'd come and stop in, chat for a bit, and they come away with a feeling that he was a lightweight. I heard that a number of times. Oh, your teacher's a lightweight. He doesn't look like Goenkaji. You know, And why was he a lightweight? I think he was a Bengali. He's very passionate, very excitable, interested in everything, and especially interested in you. And that didn't compute. He wasn't teaching deep, deep Dharma, or they thought it was. He wasn't. And it confused me when I was there. I was there several years. He never taught me meditation. Never. Not one word of instruction. That's what I went over there to learn. And it was very confusing. And I took the question home with me. And I finally realized he was teaching me something much more important than how to meditate. He was teaching me how to live. He would take me up the marketplace and show me how to, you know, negotiate with the milk wallahs. Oh, one time he said, look, why don't you come back to Bodh Gaya? Why don't you just come and stay with me in my room? And that itself was a tremendous learning. One day, maybe I was there about a year, he said to me, you are still sitting, aren't you? I said, yes, Manindraji, I'm still sitting. Oh, good, good, keep sitting. That was it. So Nisargadatta and maybe Manindraji were good examples of how spirit manifests where and how it will. Almost never according to this image we have in our minds do we hold other people, other teachers, other traditions up to. The way spirit manifests is often very unpredictable in the strangest people, in the strangest bodies. I had a lot of trouble with that in the beginning. I had this sort of image of how they're supposed to look and act and be. Doesn't work out that way. So check him out on YouTube. You see, his style is very uncompromising. He does not hesitate to shoot right from the hip. He's not a warm fuzzy. They're really powerful, right to the point teacher. But of all the teachers I know, I've known over the years, I sometimes think of it like pinging fine crystal, you know? When you ping a piece of fine crystal, what kind of sound do you get back? It's very pure. The lovely, pure sound. That's the sound he gives off when you ping him. Or you see the way he's working with some of his students. Doesn't mean that everyone loved him. A lot of students were provoked by him. I don't know any teacher that doesn't provoke a number of his students. We look to find someone we can work with, and many people we can't work with. But as I said, I've kept him on my night table for 35 years, so there's some connection there. And usually when I do read him, I will only read a page or two at a time, sometimes only a paragraph at a time. It's too powerful. It's just too powerful to take in, take all of that in. You could take one sentence that he teaches and just spend a whole day with that one sentence. So here's the passage. The teacher is a retired chartered accountant, right? And his wife was some kind of social worker, worked with the poor. And his son was leaving for the U.S., so they were coming to see him off. but they thought they would stop and talk with Sri Nisargadatta first. He said, "We feel very fortunate to be brought here. We have met many holy people, and we are glad to meet one more." Well, he turns out not to be just one more. So he asked Sri Nisargadatta, his question is, "But who creates the world?" What kind of a question is that? Who creates the world? It obviously had some relevance to the student, but my sense is that he wasn't quite ready to ask what he really wanted to ask. So he asked something kind of abstract. Who creates the world? And the Sargadatta says, the Supreme imparts reality to whatever comes into being. To say that it is the universal love may be the nearest we can come to it in words. Just like love, it makes everything real, beautiful, and desirable. Student, why desirable? Sri Nisargadatta, why not? Wherefrom come all the powerful attractions that make all created things respond to each other, that bring people together, if not from the Supreme? Shun not desire, see only that it flows into the right channels. Without desire, you are dead, but with low desires, you are a ghost. And now the student is getting closer to what he really wants to ask. His question, how does one reach the supreme state? Nisargadatta, by renouncing all lesser desires. As long as you are pleased with the lesser, you cannot have the highest. Whatever pleases you keeps you back. Until you realize the unsatisfactoriness of everything, its transiency and limitation, and collect your energies in one great longing, even the first step is not made. That was the passage that got me. And we'll come back to that. So the student's first question is kind of an avoidance of self-inquiry, asking this abstract question about how the world came into being. And Sri Nisargadatta redirects the question into a teaching about desire. And this, as you know, this is a loaded issue, right? Because according to Buddhist psychology, desire is at the root of all suffering. That is the second noble truth, isn't it? The truth of desire, the truth of the cause of suffering. And we see this over and over again in our own experience, don't we? Our own desires and pursuit of those desires often lead us astray. Desire, grasping, gets us into trouble, especially its insatiability, because it's never fulfilled, it always wants more. So that's what we expect Nisargadatta to answer. But again, he's unpredictable, he's full of surprises. He says, the Supreme, like love, makes everything real, beautiful, and desirable. Now, the student reacts to this. Probably following traditional teaching, he says, why desirable? Real is okay, beauty is okay, but desire? Why desirable? Where'd that come from? And the Sargadatta says, wherefrom come all the powerful attractions that make all created things respond to each other, that bring people together, if not from the Supreme? In other words, the Supreme or our Buddha nature or Buddha doesn't take us out of relationship. It's actually the source of relationship. It's our deepest connection. So his teaching, which the student didn't expect, is shun not desire. It's a very powerful thing to say, shun not desire. Without any desire, you're dead. You're not alive. To be alive means to desire. On the other hand, with low desires, you're a ghost. That's true too, isn't it? Your energy level is way down here. You function like a ghost. So the problem is not desire. It's seeing only that it flows into the right channels. In another satsang, Nisargadatta says to another student, he says, look, the student's complaining about struggling with desire. He says, look, the problem is not your desires. Your problem is that your desires are too small. That's wonderful. Your desires are too small. You're willing to settle for less. There's a wonderful, I don't know if it's a poem, but it's a piece by Nelson Mandela that fits right in here, that challenges us in ways that we're not used to be challenged. It's beautiful. Mandela says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. We often think that that's our deepest fear. It isn't. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. That's the link. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people will not feel insecure around you. Wow. You were born to manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just in some of us, it is in every one of us. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. That's really beautiful. Our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. A professor of mine many, many years ago wrote a book of poems called Ghosts of the Heart. And on the back of it, there was a meditation about the unicorn, the symbol of the artist. And he was talking about how he'd been mesmerized by the wound on the neck of the unicorn. That's a mythic symbol. There's a wound on the neck of the unicorn, the wounded healer or the wounded artist. And he said, I'd become much less interested in the wound. I miss the power and grace and beauty of the beast underneath. And he ended up by saying, it's not the skeleton in our closet that we fear, it's the God. That makes sense? So, how does one reach the supreme state? And why is this such a difficult and fraught question, even though it may be the most important question we'll ever ask over the course of a lifetime? It may have been the question that brought us to practice in the first place. And I find these days, I've asked that question many, many times. It is a particular salience now at turning 75. If not now, when? and had this bout with cancer. Who knows where that leads? So as difficult as the question is, as it is, it becomes like a koan that we cannot not ask. It's interesting that the student accepts that there is such a thing as the supreme state. He doesn't question that. We often in the West question that. It's not part of our kind of way of thinking about ourselves or thinking about life. But the student accepts that there is such a thing. And this was the basis of Nisargadatta's own awakening. Someone asked him once, well, how did you awaken? He said, it was very simple. I believed what my teacher told me. That's not the Western attitude, right? Which is question everything. I said, I believe what my teacher told me. And it only took me 3 years. My mind opened. And again, the Nisargadatta's answer goes right to the gut. How does one reach the supreme state? It's like, you asked for it, here it is, by renouncing all lesser desires. Whoa. That goes so against the grain. These are most of the desires I have, you know, in the course of a day or a week or a month. What do you mean renouncing all lesser desires? What does he mean by lesser, and how do we know which are lesser? And what does he mean by renouncing these lesser desires? Renunciation used to mean a turning away from the world and trying to attain some transcendent state. But mostly leaving the world. I think that's no longer, that may be the traditional meaning, but that's no longer true for us. Renunciation doesn't work if it means suppressing things, getting rid of things. That's still in the language of a lot of Buddhist teaching, other traditions as well, renunciation. But renouncing the world doesn't work for us, I don't think. And whatever is suppressed returns, and it usually returns in greater force. And our practice itself, mindfulness itself, is allowing everything to have a voice, everything to be as it is. Everything to come completely out of hiding. That's another way of thinking about mindfulness. To allow everything to come completely out of hiding and turning toward everything that parts of us would rather avoid. And I think renunciation is a notion, it's too willful. It's sort of a and that's not a true letting go. The Buddha, you know, was awakened only after he abandoned renunciation. Right? He spent those 6 years with those other monks. They practiced all these ascetical practices, and all he did was bring himself to the point of death, eating one mustard or one seed a day, one piece of grain a day, until he finally saw the folly of that, and he gave it all up. Washed himself in the river, ate, replenished his body, stopped pushing all of that away, and the mind opened. So the problem really is being pleased with the lesser. As long as you're pleased with the lesser, you cannot have the highest. That's a pretty extreme statement. I think as long as we, as long as we're focused on and zeroed in on the highest, on our deepest aspiration, there's room for lesser desires. It isn't like we've got to renounce them all. That's a little misleading, at least in our culture. There's no moral judgment here about desire, even lesser desires. Right? It's only that they don't bring us what we really want. They don't ultimately satisfy. We attribute more satisfaction to them than they can deliver. But again, note how quickly we become pleased with anything that gives us pleasure or makes us feel good. We have an instantaneous reaction to that. We're pulled toward it, drawn toward it. But it's quite possible to experience something that we want as giving pleasure, but without being caught or hooked or drawn by the pleasure. That's where we have a problem. Nothing wrong with pleasure in itself. It's when it pulls us and we identify with it that it gets in the way. So as long as you are pleased with the lesser, you cannot have the highest. Why? Because whatever pleases you keeps you back, becomes a point of fixation. We run into that all the time. He's not saying that being pleased by anything is wrong or sinful or unwholesome. Only that if our aspiration, our calling is to awaken, we'll have to deal with this issue. Put it pretty baldly, how badly do you want to wake up? What are you willing to give up to wake up? And it's very important we be clear and honest about this, not try to talk ourselves into believing something that really isn't true. Yeah, I want to wake up, but maybe way back in here, there's a little mental reservation. I'm not sure. Maybe not today, but maybe tomorrow or next year. And that's okay, as long as we're honest with ourselves about it. Practice is much more about honesty and sincerity than anything else. In that story of the, one of the stories of the Buddha's enlightenment, do you remember that Mara comes to the Buddha while he's sitting there? And he's only moments away from this great thing that's about to happen, although he doesn't know that yet. And Mara makes one last ditch effort to knock him off his perch, right? It just irritates Mara no end. That this man may be slipping from his grasp. And who is Mara? Mara is a deity in the story, but Mara really is the Buddha's shadow, right? It's our shadow side that always comes and throws these last-minute challenges to us. No different with the Buddha. And except that Mara is in a position, the Buddha's in a position, to really present him with the best that this life has to offer. And so Mara rolls out every desirable thing that he can possibly think of. And the Buddha's unmoved. And finally it's done. And there's nothing more Mara can bring and show to the Buddha. And the Buddha, that's that famous mudra, right, where his hand is pointing over his right knee and his finger pointing to the earth. And he says, "The earth will bear me witness. All this time I have been here, I have worked, I have practiced, and I ain't moving now." And he doesn't move. And Mara disappears. And then the Buddha's mind opens. Well, life offers us that again and again and again. There's a comparable story in the Gospel of Matthew in the New Testament, the Christian New Testament, where Satan takes Jesus to the top of the temple and says, some of you probably heard this story as children, and says to Jesus, you can have the whole world, all, and from the top of the temple, Jesus can see the whole world, right? Everything wonderful and beautiful and desirable in it. And Satan says, you can have it all. It's in my power to give you all of it if you will simply bow down and worship me. What are you willing to give up? How badly do you want it? And Jesus says the same thing as the Buddha. Sorry. None of it satisfies. In that great play of Goethe, Faust, see what a theme this is, because it keeps turning up as an archetype in all these different traditions. Mephistopheles wants Faust's soul. That's the dynamic of the play. And Faust says, you can have my soul if you can bring me one thing to which I will say, stay thou moment, thou art so fair. And so Mephistopheles brings, like Satan did, like Mara did, everything that could possibly bring. And Faust tastes it and says, nah, that's not it. Tastes it, no, that's not it either. And goes, tastes absolutely everything that Mephistopheles brings. And he can't say that, he can't latch on to any of it, because none of it ultimately is satisfying to him. And so Mephistopheles doesn't get his soul. Now that's another way of thinking about mindfulness practice, right? In the course of a sitting, 45 minutes we sit, all this stuff comes through. A lot of it from our shadow side. And as we become aware of each thought, each feeling, each body sensation after another, in effect, we're doing the same thing. We're testing each one of those states of consciousness, saying, are you it? Are you it? Are you it? It's like that child's storybook about the bird who falls out of the nest and loses his mother, right? And goes around to everything. Are you my mother? Are you my mother? Are you my mother? That's what we're asking all the time. And practice is a wonderful, anything, but practice is a way of doing that too. And testing, really testing, is this it? Don't just hurry by, just kind of wave at the thought on the way by, or wave at the emotion on the way by, but really hang out with it a little bit and test it, taste it, till you've really tasted it and see, is that it? Is that satisfying? And find out for yourself. So Nisargadatta's final teaching on this, this is what felt to me like a calling after so many years. He says, until you realize the unsatisfactoriness of everything, that it does not ultimately satisfy, not that it's bad, not that we shouldn't derive pleasure from it, it's just that it ultimately doesn't satisfy that deepest longing of our heart. Until you realize the unsatisfactoriness of everything, everything, he means everything, exclamation mark, its transiency and limitation, and collect your energies in one great longing, even the first step is not made. And collect your energies in one great longing, even the first step is not made. I don't know about the first step being made or not. I'm not sure what that means. But I think I have some sense of what collecting our energies in one great longing means. In Buddhist psychology, that one great longing is called a dhammachanda. It's the one form of desire that is really a wholesome form of desire, because it's desire for the Dharma, it's the desire for enlightenment. But collecting your energies into one great longing, I think probably for each one of us, we do that in a different way, and we feel a little bit different to us. But what a powerful thing to say. And I think we do have some sense that until we do that, and our longing becomes like a laser, we'll experience many, many things, but we won't experience that one thing that is our birthright above all else. It's a funny statement for a Buddhist in a way. It's very much a kind of Hindu statement that comes out of a more devotional tradition. Because longing is an emotional word, isn't it? It's devotional. It's not insight into some knowledge. It is longing. He meant longing. And if there's one problem I've had with Buddhist teaching over the years, it's that, at least in the Theravada, it lacks a kind of devotional element. It's cool. In the Visuddhimagga, it said that Vipassana is the dry vision path, that's what they call it, the dry vision path, presumably as opposed to the wet vision path. And the wet vision path is the path of devotion and emotion and longing. But longing, and especially as it gathers momentum and more gets swept up into it, it becomes this great current that carries us along. We don't have to do a whole lot except let ourselves be carried. And that's the teaching, I think, that felt like was calling me, setting me out again. To find that calling and respond to it fully, despite the impairments of age and the legacy of cancer and its treatment. It's so easy to find reasons not to do something. Oh, I'm really sick. Or, oh, I'm dying. Maybe even that. Or, oh, my mind doesn't work right anymore. I'm the last person who would want to minimize any of that. But somehow, maybe I'm speaking to myself here, somehow it's too easy to use that as an excuse. In fact, I'll stop after this. The two people I know who have gone deepest in practice, and I mean really, really deep in practice, Deepa Ma is one, whom a number of you know, and people have started writing things about her and telling her story. So, and she came here and visited, so she's more widely known here. Extraordinary woman. And the other is also a woman. Guys, there may be a message for us in there. An Australian woman. And both of them reached the springboard to their realization was their own very profound suffering. The suffering sometimes can open us up and stretch us in ways that ordinary daily life doesn't. It's not that we ought to go out and seek it. It's just that it's often the vehicle. And with Deepa Ma, just briefly, as some of you know, she had a very happy childhood. Not one of these teachers that had a very unhappy childhood. She had a very blissful childhood. Was much loved as a child. Married when she was 12. But her husband was wonderful. He didn't ask her to come live with him. He let her stay with the family for another 2 or 3, 4 years, because she was appalled at the idea of marriage when she found out what it involved. But he let her stay at home. He went back to Rangoon until she felt ready. And then she came and joined him in Rangoon. And the next problem was that she couldn't conceive, which was terrible for an Indian woman, even a Buddhist. And the years went by, I think 18 years went by. And finally, she did conceive, and she had 3 children in the space of 4 or 5 years. And then her first child died. Her husband, again, was wonderful. She used to call her husband my first guru. That's the way she always referred to him, my first guru, my first teacher. He was so gentle and so kind and understanding. He never pushed himself on me. But in the space of 3 years, she lost 2 of her 3 children and her husband. And she said, I was on fire with grief. And the doctor came, examined her, and gave her 3 weeks to live. And so she said an interesting thing. She said, I looked around, and I said, well, if I'm going to die, what can I take with me when I die? Kind of an odd question. And she said, I looked at my dowry, and I couldn't take that. I looked at my daughter, my surviving daughter, and knew I couldn't take her, even her, as painful as that was. She said, let me go to the meditation center. Maybe I can find something there. So she went to the center. She got the instructions that night. The next morning, she's walking across campus to give report to her teacher. And suddenly, she couldn't move, pinned to the spot. And she said she must have been there about 10 or 15 minutes. Finally, she looked down, and this huge bull mastiff had clamped his jaws around her leg and was holding her right to the spot. But she was in such deep samadhi that she never felt it. But they had to interrupt her practice and rush her off to a hospital and get, rabies shots. And when she finally came back to the center, she finished the whole course of practice in 6 days. She was not in that being on fire with grief. She was not holding on to very, very much at all. And she just surrendered it. It wasn't even that conscious or deliberate a thing. It was just that surrender. And same thing with Carol. Carol came from an alcoholic family in Holland. And when she was a teenager, the Germans invaded and took over Holland, and she joined the Dutch resistance. And for 4 years, she was fearless. She did all of these missions, which were really unbelievable. The last one was she somehow got a Gestapo uniform and presented herself as someone from the Rommel's North Africa Corps to the Gestapo headquarters in Amsterdam and demanded a command car and a chauffeur to take her on a tour of the North Sea coastal installations. They were the most top secret thing that the Germans had. Sure enough, she got the command car, she got the chauffeur, she got the tour, and she fed all that information back to the Allies, and that's how they decided on the beaches that they would land on in Normandy. But just before the end of the war, the Germans rolled up her network, and they tortured and killed and executed 20 of the 21 people. She was the last. They tortured her for 2 days, and she was scheduled to be executed the following day. That night, some Dutch commandos broke into the prison and rescued her. So she survived the war, but she was very bitter and had two unhappy marriages, two sons that she was estranged from at the time I knew her, and finally emigrated to Holland, but she was so impossible to work with. She was an angry, rageful woman. And finally got blackballed by the Australian oil industry. She was a geologist. They couldn't work with her. They refused to hire her. And she said, I had nothing left. So she made 3 attempts to take her life. The third one was very carefully planned out. She lived in kind of in the outback, where people never came by. This one day, a friend of hers happened to come by and pulled her out of the oven. And so she survived. But she said, what do I do now? I can't even kill myself. I can't live. I can't die. What do I do? So she had heard about Manindra, and she'd read just a little bit on Buddhism, never done any practice. She sold her car and a few things in her house. She went to Bodh Gaya with money for about maybe for 3 months. And she was living in the Zen temple when I got there, practicing. And she was still a terror. She would go up and have these consultations with her teacher, with Manindraji, and she would just curse him out. You're such a terrible teacher. You don't know how to teach me. Blah, blah, blah. And she said, if this is all you can do, I'm going home. I'm packing my bags and going home tomorrow. If you haven't even taught me the first thing about meditation. He said, oh, you want to learn about meditation. Why didn't you say so? So he gave us some very basic instructions. And she tried to, there were all these other Australians, fellow Australians around the temple at that point. And they're all doing this intensive practice. And she leapt in to try to do this intensive practice, and it drove her nuts. She wasn't ready to do intensive practice. So she went back to Manindraji again. He said, who told you to do intensive practice? I didn't tell you to do that. It's these Australian guys that are, getting in your grill about that. You sit when you want to sit and don't sit when you don't want to sit. And that was his path to enlightenment. Probably work for all of us. Sit when you want to sit, don't sit when you don't want to sit. So that's what she did. And very soon she really got deeply into it. And I went away for New Delhi. I think I went to New Delhi for Christmas. And when I came back, she was walking about a foot off the ground. And I said to Manindra, did it happen? He said, yeah. She experienced. She was just radiant. Just radiant. But again, like Deepama, she wasn't holding on to very much. The suffering had really scoured her out in many ways. So she went home for a year. She came back the second Christmas. She experienced second path. And then she said an interesting thing. She said, I'm not coming back. This is it. I'm not going to practice for third path. I asked her why. She said, well, this may all just be a lot of Buddhist bullshit, mumbo jumbo, but it said that if you attain third path, you won't come back to the human plane anymore. Second path, you come back one time. Third path, you don't come back at all. So she said, my life has been so unhappy, so miserable this time, that I'd like to come back at least one more time and see some of the good things that this life has to offer. So I'm not going to practice for third path. And I guess she didn't. She and I used to exchange letters every Christmas after we went home. So 10 years went by, and I got a letter from her that 10th Christmas that started out, whoops. I made a mistake. I started practicing for Third Path. I guess I'm not coming back. And then her sons wrote me after she died. And she, oh, by the way, I didn't mention, when she was doing this intensive practice on the way to her mind opening, she would sit all day long at her desk writing in her journals with stacks of these filthy Gauloises cigarettes piled up alongside her, and she chain-smoked her way through the whole day. Only person I know that chain-smoked their way to enlightenment. But when she died of emphysema. I mean, you don't escape your karma, no matter how enlightened you are. And that was okay, though, with her, it was okay. Her sons had a little bit of a problem with it. They wrote me a lovely letter, but a little bit anguished. And I said to them, you know, if I ever knew anyone who was ready to die, it was your mom. You should absolutely have no worry about her whatsoever. Extraordinary woman. So, I think we know from our ordinary experience that any kind of sickness can open us up or it can close us down. It doesn't automatically open us up. With Eckhart Tolle, it opened him up, and he, instead of killing himself, which he planned to do like Carol, mind opened. So anything, everything can be used in the service of the original intention of our practice. Okay, let's stop there. I didn't mean to quite go on quite so long. Those of you who need to go or want to go or have been driven away,